Welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, delivering programs from radio's golden years. I'm your host, Mark LeVonier. Drama coming up in this hour. Later on, we hear Marlena Dietrich in a play from 1949, but right now it's the Radio Reader's Digest, starring Paul Muni in The Master Swindle, the CBS broadcast from January 1st, 1948.
A Hallmark card will best express your perfect taste, your thoughtfulness. Makers of Hallmark greeting cards present The Master Swindle, starring Paul Muni. Now to preside over our program, here is your Hallmark host, Les Tremaine.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is the day of new wishes and new hopes. Ours is simply to bring you another year of great entertainment on the Hallmark program. We're starting tonight with a strange story of intrigue and one man's ambition in one of the most startling stories to come out of post-war Europe. And to play it, we have that superb actor, Paul Muni. Happy New Year, Paul, and welcome to the Hallmark program.
Thank you, Les. As a matter of fact, this is the only place I'd care to be tonight.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the makers of Hallmark greeting cards bring you on the Reader's Digest radio edition a great dramatic story. We call it The Master Swindle, and our star is Mr. Paul Muni.
Exhibit, Helen. If the critics are unkind to me again, I will give up painting forever.
Oh, darling, you know you can't ever do that. If you gave up painting, you'd be giving up your whole life.
Like all the men who devote their lives to painting, I'm guilty of two crimes, perhaps. A great pride in my work and an even greater ego. Oddly enough, I had a minor reputation in Holland, and I made good money as an artist. But every time my work was exhibited, the critics panned me unmercifully. So much so that my wife refused to let me see their reviews.
Now, don't ask me again, Ernest. There isn't a newspaper in the house, and if there were, I would have destroyed the art reviews.
Darling, you're treating me like a little baby.
I'm treating you like an artist, dear, which is practically the same thing.
But how could I paint if I don't know what the people think of my painting?
That's the only way you can paint, Ernest. As soon as you see a review, you start breaking easels.
Sweetheart, why must you deprive me of the pleasure of getting mad?
Because you're a fine artist, Ernest. And these fools who say you're too commercial only set you back.
What fool said I was commercial?
Oh.
Huss. Paul Huss. It sounds like him. He doesn't approve of my work because I see the beauty in things.
Darling.
That pompous little pimple. If I don't paint a nose with a wart on it, he thinks it's commercial. What else did he say?
Nothing.
Helen, please stop buttering me. The man has two columns in the newspaper. He can't fill it with nothing.
Well, it wasn't such a bad review. He compared you with Vermeer.
Yes, I can imagine how he did it, too. Ernest C. Brandt is nothing but a cheap imitation of Vermeer.
Well, what difference does it make what he said?
It isn't what he said, dear. It's what they all say, year after year, tearing me down, smothering me inside, and not even knowing what I'm trying to do.
They'll know someday,
Not
Ernest.
These idiots. They're killing me, darling. They're killing me. These smug little men who pass sentence on what is good and what isn't. Do you think they know the difference?
No.
A modern artist hasn't a chance with these fakers. All they do is worship the old masters, and Holland has so many old masters, they just won't let a new one be born.
Well, they can't prevent you from being born, Ernest. 100 years from now...
Never mind about 100 years from now. What did Haas say about me today?
I'm not going to tell you.
All right. Don't tell me. I'll find out for myself.
Ernest, where are you going?
I'm going to call on Mr. Haas in person and make him tell me to my face what is wrong with my paintings. Yes? Go on with your critique, Mr. Haas. I'm very anxious to know how I can improve my painting.
Well, your technique, it's too slick. It shows that you have been painting rich Americans. Fat women who feel flattered when you finish a portrait for them.
And Rembrandt never painted fat women?
Rembrandt? Good heavens, you don't think you're in a class with Rembrandt, do you?
I'm waiting for you to tell me how I can be.
You can't. Rembrandt had warmth, style, color. Your work is livid compared to his.
Because I don't paint in an attic with an old bathrobe on and a broken-down stove in the middle of the room? Because I don't paint men with walrus mustaches and homely old biddies with missing teeth?
Because you don't paint. You simply work for a living.
And what do you do?
Mr. Seabrand, you are commissioned to do about 10 portraits a year, aren't you?
Approximately.
And for each of these portraits, you receive about $1,000, am I right?
Approximately.
Well, that's a tidy sum of money. Do you know how much I make for writing these reviews?
Approximately.
$52 a week.
You're overpaid.
I think I am underpaid, Mr. Seabrand. Especially if I give an art exhibit a good review. Good reviews make a rich artist richer, and yet they don't put a penny in my pocket unless I am rewarded.
You mean you take money to write a good review?
I said a good review puts money in your pocket, not mine. Unless, of course, you appreciate the value of a good review.
I can't believe it.
Why not? People always like to earn money, Mr. Seabrand. That's why you're an artist.
And that's why you're a lizard. How dare you criticize my painting in one breath and ask for a bribe in another?
Mr. Seabrand.
I ought to strangle you with my bare hands.
I will have to ask you to leave, Mr.
Seabrand. I leave without your asking, you imposter. You don't know what makes Rembrandt a great artist. You don't know anything about art at all. Unless it's signed by an old master. Without a label, you couldn't tell the difference.
My dear sir, there is no way to talk to an art critic.
I'm not talking to an art critic. I'm talking to a thief.
Well, if that's the way you feel about us, just wait until your next exhibit.
It panned me even worse after that. All of them, Haas's cronies, went out of their way to make disparaging remarks about my work in their daily columns. I stood it for a while because there was nothing else I could do. And then one day, I thought of a way of getting even with them.
Ernest, you can't.
Why not? They won't know the difference. Those muddleheads judge a painting by the signature, not by what's on the canvas.
Well, even so, everybody knows a Vermeer.
Everybody, but not a critic. They'll rave about it, I tell you. A genuine Vermeer. They've got to rave about it. He was an old master.
But, darling, it's taking an awful chance. If anybody finds out you signed Vermeer's name to one of your paintings, well, you'll be disgraced forever.
If those critics know the difference, I deserve to be disgraced.
But you can be sent to prison, can't you? For forging someone else's name on your own painting?
It's worth taking a chance, Helen. Just think what it will mean if they rave about a painting of mine because Vermeer's name is on it. Think of how it will blast them out of their comfortable little thrones when I tell the world what fools they are. It'll make me, darling. It will give me a chance to prove that I'm a great artist.
I don't know, Ernest. You are a fine artist, but painting in Vermeer's style and signing his name, it's such a risk. Just to play a joke on the critic.
It's an opportunity to break the stranglehold these men have on the artistic world. Young artists won't be at their mercy anymore.
But it seems so impossible. How can you paint a fake Vermeer? Aren't all of his works cataloged?
I'll paint a new one. An undiscovered one. I'll buy 17th century linen for the canvas and grind my own pigment. I'll make a thorough study of his works, and by the time I finish my painting, I'll defy the experts to tell the difference.
You think you can paint in Vermeer's style, darling? I mean, well enough to look like an old master?
Don't worry, dear. I'll paint the greatest Vermeer ever painted.
The style of an old master is not an easy job. I knew the risk I was taking. Forgery is a 2-year offense. So I followed Vermeer's rules meticulously, day after day, for the 7 months it took me to complete the painting. Then I scratched cracks into the surface of the paint and baked them apart in the kitchen stove. And when I had added 300 years of antiquity to the old master I had just finished painting, I took it to my old friend, Mr. Haas.
Where did you get this, Seabrand?
Oh, I picked it up in Italy about 3 weeks ago. It was part of a private collection.
Is it genuine?
Why, of course. Can't you tell?
Well, it certainly looks like a Vermeer, but I don't see anything in the catalog about it. What did you say it was called?
Christ at Emmaus.
Well, I can't understand why it isn't listed. But if this is an uncatalogued discovery, it's worth a fortune.
Well, I don't care about the value of it, Mr. Haas.
Are you crazy? Boymans Museum is looking for a Vermeer. They'll pay any amount of money for one if it's authentic.
Well, I'm not selling it. I mean, I just wanted to know what you thought of it.
What do you mean you're not selling it? Why not?
Well,
you have no right to keep a discovery like this to yourself. It's an art treasure if it's a Vermeer.
Oh, it's a Vermeer, all right.
Well, let's find out. Let us take it up to Boymans Museum and have it tested.
This is a remarkable painting, Mr. Sebrandt. We've x-rayed the canvas, penetrated the overlays with quartz lamps, and tested the effect of alcohol on the colors.
Well, what did you find?
It's a Vermeer, all right. A genuine Vermeer.
I'm buying it, darling. They want it for an immediate showing, and they're willing to pay an enormous price.
Well, you can't take it, Ernest.
But Helen, if they buy it, they'll move out that Holbein and put my painting in its place. And listen to this review, Helen. The new Vermeer at Boymans displays the refinement of technique, the pointille touch, and the exquisite yellow and blue coloring so familiar to admirers of the old master. Christ at Emmaus is by far Vermeer's best effort.
Ernest, you home already?
Yes, dear.
Well, how was it? What did they say?
Who?
The people at Boymans. Weren't you going to tell them today that the painting was a fake?
Yes.
Ernest, didn't you tell them?
No.
Well, why not, darling?
Well, I couldn't tell it. The words wouldn't come out of my mouth. All I could do was stand there and look at the painting. It was such a thrill to see it hanging there. My painting.
But, Ernest, it isn't your painting.
Isn't it? Didn't I create it with my own hands? I didn't copy a picture of Vermeer's. I made one of my own, with his name on it. And it's the best thing I've ever done.
Well, I know, but...
Darling, you should have heard how they raved about it. Critics from all over the world. Seeing what I saw in it, admiring the composition, the mood. It's really great art. Helen, do you know what they did while I was there?
What, dear?
They made the porters bring out a carpet and place it on the floor underneath the painting so there wouldn't be any sound of footsteps while people were contemplating the picture.
Ernest.
Yes, dear.
Aren't you going to tell them?
I can tell them. Not after seeing it hanging there. Not after hearing what they said about it. I simply can't let them take it down.
Well, what are you going to do?
Well... the only thing I can do, darling, I'm going to paint another. It was a thrill to know I could paint like Vermeer, whether the rest of the world knew about it or not. So I kept on painting. I painted six in all, five of which were hanging in the finest galleries in Europe. But it was the sixth one that gave me the most pleasure. It was during the war then, when Holland was overrun with the Nazis and Hermann Göring was stealing art treasures from all the occupied countries. One of his agents came to see me one day.
You don't seem to understand, Mr. Sebrandt. Marshal Göring is looking for a Vermeer painting. And you have sold so many of them, you must surely know where I can get another.
I know of nothing, Mr. Schmidt.
But the Marshal is willing to pay for this picture. He won't seize it from you.
I have nothing to seize.
Come, come, Sebrandt. I happen to know you have another Vermeer in your possession. If you refuse to sell it to me, I will buy it from your widow. After all, it can be arranged that way, too.
Well, I do know of another Vermeer.
I want it, Mr. Seabrand, within 24 hours. I will give you a check for it tomorrow morning.
$600,000 marks, Helen. That swine Gehring paid for it out of his own pocket. Imagine 600,000 marks for a fake art treasure.
This time the money pleases me, Adam.
Pleases you, darling. This is the greatest swindle in history. And Hermann Gehring is the goat.
A year after that, the war ended, and Hermann Gehring's collection of stolen art, along with my Vermeer painting, were found and classified by the United States Army. And among the experts who were called in to identify the pictures was a Dutch investigator named Lundstedt.
What seems to be the trouble, Lundstedt? Are you having difficulty locating the museum Gehring stole this from?
No, Colonel. What troubles me is the fact that this Vermeer was not stolen at all.
You mean it was a gift?
Hardly. No museum in Holland would give Herr Gehring anything, least of all a famous painting. It was sold to him by a private collector.
Sold?
For something like 600,000 marks, according to these files.
Well, I'm glad to hear that Fatzel really had to pay for something.
I'm not. This painting was sold by a Hollander.
More power to him.
You don't understand, Colonel. In my country, Vermeer is a national hero, like Rembrandt. Streets are named in his honor. And reproductions of his works are hung in even the poorest homes. A genuine Vermeer is a national treasure. No one has the right to sell it to a pig like Gehring.
I see what you mean.
The man who sold this painting is a pig himself. And what is more, he will be punished for it.
Open up. Open up in the name of the law.
Why? What's wrong, officer?
Mr. Seabrand? Ernest Seabrand?
Yes?
Get your hat, Seabrand. Come with me. You're under arrest.
Arrest? I don't understand. On what charge are you arresting me?
The most contemptible charge there is. Collaboration with the enemy.
Gentlemen, please, I'm not a collaborator.
You sold that painting, didn't you?
Yes, I sold it, yes, to an agent, but I wasn't collaborating with the enemy.
No? Where did you get it?
Why, I bought it from an Italian dealer. It was part of a private collection.
Bought it from an Italian fascist and sold it to a Nazi. No, you're not a collaborationist. You're just a skunk.
Now, you see here the painting I sold to Gehring.
Yes.
Well, it wasn't a national treasure. I mean...
What do you mean, Seabrand? It was a Vermeer, wasn't it?
Well, yes, it was. It's a Vermeer, but it wasn't worth the price he paid for it.
What's that got to do with it?
Well, nothing, I suppose. But if I could just make you understand that I...
That you what?
Nothing, I can't tell you.
You'd better tell us, Seabrand, everything you know. Collaboration is a serious offense, punishable by death.
Good Lord. You wouldn't hang a man for selling a painting, would you?
This was more than a painting. You did Herr Gehring a great favor when you let him have this masterpiece. And I'm sure he returned that favor in many ways.
That's a lie. I was treated the same as anybody else.
Sit down, Seabrand.
And let you accuse me of seeking favors from men like Gehring and the rest of those swine? Don't you think I saw what they did to us here? Where do you suppose I was during the war? In Switzerland?
Sit down, Seabrand.
No, I sat for 5 long years. While they starved us and stole from us and killed the little children in the street. I sat down while they lived in my house, giving me orders at the point of a bayonet and slapping me with those greasy paws. Do you think I collaborate with them?
All right, that's enough.
Gentlemen, I've done many things in my life, but I've never been a traitor to my country. I request permission to make a confession. I told him my story just as I've told it to you. And when I was finished, the chief of police looked at me and said...
That's an astounding story, Seabrand.
I know it is, Mynheer. I hated to admit I forged these paintings, but I've proved I'm not a collaborationist.
It remains to be seen. I've heard confessions before.
What are you driving at?
It's a good story, Seabrand, but I don't happen to believe it.
Good glory. Do you think I made it up?
It would be a fairly smart idea if you did. Dodging a big crime by confessing a small one is an old standby. Only it isn't going to work in this case.
But you're insane if you...
Insane or not, I'm going to have this painting examined by experts. They'll know if you're telling the truth.
No, they won't. They've examined it before.
They'll examine it again. And if this painting is a genuine Vermeer, your confession won't be worth a hang.
I can't go back on my word. I said it was a Vermeer before, and I say it's a Vermeer again.
Seabrand can't discredit us. He knows it's a Vermeer. He's just lying to save his neck.
And after using every test known to this museum, it is our opinion that the painting is a genuine Vermeer.
It's an outrage. An outrage, I tell you. Those fools are making the same mistake all over again. Either that, or they're afraid to admit the first one.
Naturally, everyone's wrong but you, Mr. Seabrand.
Naturally. I painted those pictures. I know they're a fake.
And the Boyman's Museum paid you over $100,000 for a fake.
Boyman's Museum was swindled. Just the way Goering was. They couldn't distinguish my work from Vermeer's.
You expect me to believe you paint as well as Jan Vermeer? You're going to stand trial for collaborating.
Now, wait a minute. I can prove I painted those Vermeer's. Prove it beyond a question of a doubt.
How?
By painting another one. Then the experts will have to admit they made a mistake.
You mean you're going to paint another Vermeer right here in prison?
If you let me have the materials I need, I can do it in 6 months to a year.
I'll give you 8 weeks, Mr. Seabrand. And if you can't paint a new Vermeer, the trial goes on.
And if I can,
you'll be arrested for forgery.
Lazuli. I need the powdered stones, and I can't use linseed oil. It won't dry.
Badger hair brushes. Only badger hair. And don't forget to overheat the paint.
It's done, Helen. At last, it's done. Oh, they rushed me so I never thought I'd finish.
Well, you're not finished yet, Ernest.
Why not?
I've got to take it home and bake it in the kitchen stove.
Amazing. You're an amazing man, Mr. Seabrand.
You like the painting?
It's remarkable. The refinement of technique, the blues and the yellows, the exquisite detail. I didn't think it was possible for any man to copy someone else's style so completely without a single flaw.
Oh, but there are flaws. The hands, for instance, they're mine, not Vermeer's. And that chair in the background is like the one in my studio. Chairs like that didn't even exist 300 years ago.
Even so, it's still a Vermeer.
No. Don't say that. It's a fake. A forgery.
It may be a forgery, Mr. Seabrand, but it's not a fake. This is real art, no matter who painted it.
You really think so?
Vermeer would have been proud of it. And you should be, too.
Proud of another man's work.
Your work, Seabrand. Another man's name. The pity of it is, you could have done just as well if you'd painted under your own name.
Could I? Well, perhaps I will now that I know who I am. If I ever get out of jail, I'll paint as I've never painted before. And maybe someday, someone will copy me.
Now, once again, here is the star of tonight's show, Paul Muni. Paul, you certainly gave us an exciting word picture of Ernest Seabrand, whose real name was Hans von Meegren.
Well, yes, he must have been quite a man. I was sorry to have to read in the papers yesterday that he died in a hospital in Holland before ever serving his prison term for forgery. By the way, I'd like to meet your star next week, Mady Christians. She's one of my very, very best favorite actresses.
And one of mine, too, Paul. Ladies and gentlemen, we hope you'll all be listening next week when the makers of Hallmark greeting cards bring you a true story from the Reader's Digest, America's favorite magazine. The Woman Who Couldn't Come Home, starring Mady Christians. In tonight's story, Paul Moody was supported by Hester Sondergaard in the role of Helen. The Master Swindle was dramatized by Robert Sloan and was based on the true story by Irving Wallace entitled The Man Who Swindled Goering, as it appeared in the Reader's Digest, America's favorite magazine. The Hallmark program was directed by Mark Sloan, with music especially composed by Jack Miller. And now this is your Hallmark host, Les Tremaine, saying goodnight to you all until next week at the same time. See you then. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
The Radio Reader's Digest on Tuned to Yesterday from New Year's Day 1948 on CBS. In the coming year, movie actor Paul Muni would only star in two television shows, the Philco Goodyear Television Playhouse and the Chevrolet Teletheater. It's an hour of drama on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier, and now a William Spear production of the Philip Morris Playhouse, heard on CBS from March 11, 1949. Marlena Dietrich stars in Esther McCoy's The Lady from the Sea.
Johnny presents the Philip Morris Playhouse, produced, edited, and directed by William Spear. Tonight's star, Marlena Dietrich.
Ho, ho, Philip Morris!
And now, with Marlena Dietrich as star, we bring you The Lady from the Sea. Tonight's production in the Philip Morris Playhouse.
When I woke up that morning, I was frightened. I had been dreaming that there was a shadow over me. It was large and black and was strangely shaped. I could not think what made such a shadow. Then I remembered what it was, and I started to run. It was the shadow of a ship.
Miss Lily, what is it? You scare the living daylights out of a body. What is it, dearie?
It was a dream.
Oh.
It's all right, Mrs. Maloney. I had a bad dream. It woke me up.
Well, now, go back to sleep for a bit. It's not 9 yet. You need your rest, and Mr. Taggart's taking you to an interview.
Did he say today?
The script just arrived. He wants you to read it this morning before you go out to Hemisphere Studio to meet the producer.
I forgot it was today.
Now, I'll put on the nightlight in your dressing room. Fix the door so there's a sliver of light. Then you won't be scared again and you can go back to sleep.
No, I'm not going back to sleep.
Now, Miss Lily, you lie there and think and get cross, and that brings out the little lines on your forehead, and you want to look your best.
Stop it. Don't fuss over me. Bring me some coffee, please, and the morning papers, all of them, and hurry. I wasn't thinking then about the dream. I wanted to see if my name was in the columns. But on the front page was a photograph. The picture of a ship with big black letters across the hull. The Lady from the Sea. Old cafe built like a ship at the end of Paradise Pier, sold for movie set. Favorite meeting place of Hollywood stars on the day of silent films. Will be background for thriller based on sensational Craig Douglas killing, which shook movie colony in 1929. Hemisphere will produce murder picture. Mrs. Maloney!
Yes, Miss Lily?
That script here?
Yes.
Give it to me.
Well, it isn't a whole script. There's only 8
pages. Give it to me.
The rest... Oh, well, now you're supposed to read the part of Norma.
Norma?
Yes, she's killed. The wife. Oh, it's a lovely title for a picture now, isn't it?
The Lady from the Sea. A story about a murder set on the Lady from the Sea. About a woman named Norma who was killed there. It couldn't be the true story, I told myself. Nobody knew the true story except Craig and me. But I was to read the part of Norma. And I was now the same age Norma had been then. I started to read. Fade in titled Hollywood 29. This is backed by a series of shots establishing the period. Theater Marquise, Janet Gaynor and Charles Perrell in Seventh Heaven. Emilianix in The Last Command and so on. Over the montage, a jingly rendition of When Francis Dances With Me. As the title fades from the screen, we dissolve to Long Shot Paradise Pier Night. In the foreground, the penny arcade from which the music we hear is coming. Two lovers, Doug and Grateful, are walking past the arcade arm in arm. Camera moves in medium close and trucks with him. But the two lovers were really Craig and Lily. Craig and me. That spring, we had dinner nearly every night at the Lady from the Sea. And we walked so many nights on the pier, arm in arm.
Here, a penny a shot, a penny a roll.
Come on, sweetheart. Let's squander a penny in the fortune machine, huh?
We already know our fortune.
Yes, we're going to live happily ever after.
Not if Norma has her way.
Forget about Norma. Listen to this. I have a warm and loving nature, but I'm also practical. Now, how do they know?
It's obvious. Now, mine.
Go on, read it.
You have high ideals, but are much too impetuous.
And a good thing, too. Come on, darling, let's take a walk. Clear to the end of the pier.
First, I want to see the pictures flip over in the movie machine.
Charlie, come look at Charlie's got his foot in the spittoon. A lady standing behind a blind as naked as Eve. Go on, it's past the scene. Oh, look, there's Craig Douglas.
Where? Yes, sir.
Oh, now we're in for it. Come on, Lily, let's run.
A coward. I wouldn't have run.
I don't want people gossiping about you and me. So far, we've kept you out of the papers.
Maybe I want to be in the papers.
As an actress, yes. Or as my wife. But not like this. Oh, Lily, someday you'll play the Lady from the Sea, the Ibsen. What is it now? Oh, yes. He took from his pocket a key ring.
He took from his pocket a key ring and drew a ring that he always wore from his finger. And he took a small ring he had. Those two he put on the key ring.
And then he said we would wed ourselves to the sea.
That's the only kind of wedding we'll ever have. Norma will never...
She'll give me a divorce. Just be patient, darling. Don't worry about Norma. Just leave everything to me.
Except for the names... It was all there in the script, word for word. And there were other scenes I remembered, word for word. The scene when the young actress called Gretel in the script, who was really me, got her first big part in a picture. And a scene when the crew on the picture presented the actress with an onyx-handled paper knife. There was a gold plate on the side, engraved with her name and the name of the picture. When you pressed the plate, the thin, tapered blade of Swedish steel sprang out. How well I remembered that knife. It was the very evening that knife had been presented to me that we met to talk about the divorce, Craig and Norma and I, in the little deck house aboard the Lady from the Sea. Then Craig was called down to the dining salon, and when Norma and I were alone, she turned on me.
You can talk until doomsday, but I'm not going to divorce Craig, ever.
Then he'll have to divorce you. I'm sure he has grounds for divorce, Norma.
Possibly. Before I see him marrying a conniving, greedy would-be like you, I'll...
Yes? Go on. What will you do?
I'll kill you. I'll kill you.
Stay where you are, Norma. I warn you. Don't touch me. Don't!
I'll fix that beautiful face so he'll never want to look at it again.
I told you
not to touch me.
Somehow, I had a knife in my hand. The little onyx-handled knife. And when Norma came at me, I pressed the gold plate and the thin blade had sprung out. And somehow, I can't imagine, but I had buried it deep in Norma's throat. She turned and looked at me, only a second, with a kind of surprise. Then she fell. And there was blood dripping into her hair. And suddenly, Craig was there.
I thought I heard it. Oh, Lily, what have you done? What have you done?
She said she'd kill me.
Oh, darling. Oh, get out of here quickly without being seen. Get out of here.
What are you doing?
This knife has your name on it. I have to get rid of it.
How?
Throw it into the sea. Get home, darling, and stay there. After I throw away the knife, I'll have to phone the police.
No, Craig. They'll say you did it.
Leave that to me. So long as they don't find out that you... It would ruin you.
I won't let you do it.
You will. Lily, do you think I care what happens to me as long as you're safe? I don't care if I have to go to prison to make certain you're safe. And you're going to wait for me.
I was shaking. I was reading all this in the picture script. The script for a picture that was going into production today. After all my troubles and waiting for the opportunity for a comeback, they were offering me a picture in which I would reenact this murder for my own life. Craig had written it. And he said he loved me. It was all in that script, scene for scene, word for word, as only he and I knew it had happened. But I didn't need a script to remember Craig's trial, to remember how he confessed that he killed Norma. He said that during a quarrel, she struck him and he lost his head. No premeditation. She was known to be a hellion and a bad drinker. His lawyers based his whole defense on that one point.
I didn't mean to kill her, as God is my witness. I lost my head.
But the prosecution based its case for premeditation, for murder in the first degree, on the disappearance of the murder weapon.
And what was the weapon, Mr. Duggan?
I've told you it was an ice pick.
An ice pick?
Yes.
And what happened to that ice pick?
I don't know.
I think I can suggest what happened to it. I think that coolly, cold-bloodedly, you pulled the weapon out of your dead wife's throat and disposed of it according to plan. Threw it into the sea.
But Craig won, if you can call it a victory. The jury brought in a verdict for murder in the second degree. The sentence was 20 years. And that same evening, after the verdict, I saw Craig. We sat for a long time quietly. I had my face in my hands.
Oh, don't cry, darling. Our time's almost up, and you're not to come here again.
I won't see you again.
Well, we've been lucky to keep your name out of this up till now. I don't want to take any more chances. But I'll write through my lawyer, and you'll write to me.
I'll be old by the time you come back.
You'll be a great actress by then, and that'll make you happy. That's worth the 20 years to me.
Oh, Craig. But what if you're wrong? What if you gave up your freedom for nothing? And it was for nothing. Because that year, sound came to motion pictures, and heads rolled, mine among them. All of us went. Unless you were already a big name, already on top. I wasn't. It had been a long, slow grind to get within sight of the top. It was a fast ride down. Way down. So I didn't write to Craig at first because I was ashamed. Later, I didn't write because, well, it was something I wanted to forget. But I didn't forget what he had said about my future as an actress. It took years of waiting, scheming, before I had my first real break, singing in a New York club. In a small way, I had a success that got me back to the coast. I opened in a club on the strip, and the papers were full of the comeback of Lily Dawn. Then I came home one night. I was staying at the Garden of Valor.
Hello, Lily.
He pushed right in, Miss Lily. I couldn't stop him.
I knew she'd be glad to see an old friend after 20 years.
Please leave, Mrs. Maloney.
If you say so. But I'll be right in my room if you need me.
What do you want?
You, Lily. I still want you.
Now, don't let's talk like idiots, Craig. That's all over.
Yes. It was all over for you rather quickly, wasn't it? Just a matter of hours after I was in prison.
Now, Craig, you don't...
You found it difficult to write to me. Was that it, Lily?
Yes, exactly.
I got to writing the last 5 years. I've written something quite remarkable. A story that ought to be front page news.
I wish I had something for you, Craig. Some money, but I haven't anything.
Oh? From the newspapers, I thought you were doing all right. Not as well as I predicted, but still.
I spend every cent I make. You know this business. They 10% me to death. My agent, my business manager, a press agent. I can't even pay my taxes.
Isn't that tough?
I'm gambling everything to get a part in a picture.
But for an old, old friend, Lily.
Why should I? I don't owe you anything.
Well, let's put it that I loaned you 20 years to pay off a very pressing debt.
Let's put it that you gave me 20 years. You don't have any claim on me. And there isn't any way you can connect me with...
With murder, Lily?
You haven't got anything that will implicate me.
No, Lily. I wouldn't be too sure. Good night, Lily.
What could Craig do? The knife was gone. He'd thrown it into the sea. And he'd been so careful to keep my name out of the case. Almost no one knew that I had even known Craig. But now my agent had sent a script, The Lady from the Sea, an unfinished script, only 80 pages. But word for word, scene for scene, it was the story of Craig and Norma and me. And I was to play the part of Norma.
What do you want, the lead or Lily? You gotta face facts.
I won't play it, Tagger.
It's a small part, I grant you, Lily, and you're killed halfway through the picture. But me, leave me, honey. There's an Academy Award in it for supporting actress, and you can do it.
I'm telling you, it's not because the part is small. I just don't like it.
But it was written for you special. The author, he told me so himself. Oh, you know Craig Douglas, the guy that did time for bumping off his own wife. He said you were the only actress in town who could do justice to the part in Norma.
I won't do it. How many times do I have to tell you?
Okay. Okay. Have it your own way. But before I tell the producer it's no soap, do me one favor.
What?
Craig Douglas told me he thought you might turn it down. I told him he was off his nut. He's a mysterious...
And what did he say?
Well, he said you should talk to him before you threw the part away. He said he could give you at least one good reason why not playing the part would be professional suicide for you. Curtains.
So I took a cab to 620 North Corona Drive, Beverly Hills. Between selling the script and The Lady from the Sea, Craig was doing very well indeed. He was living in a garden apartment by the pool, number 18.
Oh, come in, Lily. Come to talk story?
I read your script.
And you didn't like it, huh? Sit down. Sit down, Lily. I'm sorry. That part was tailored for you.
What did you want to tell me?
Well, I thought technically you might give me a few pointers on the stabbing scene, how both of the women would feel.
I didn't come here for jokes. What do you want?
I want you to take that part, Lily, and I thought you might after I discussed the script with you, especially certain scenes that are missing.
I know the script wasn't finished.
Oh, I don't mean the end of the script. The ending depends on what I do with certain other missing scenes.
What scenes?
Here, I'll show you. On page 70, if you remember, Doug has run up to the deckhouse, found his wife dead, and has taken the knife out of her throat. Holding the knife, he talks to the actress he loves. His last line in the scene is, you're going to be a great actress if I have to go to prison to make certain you are. And you're going to wait for me. Then the actress exits, as you see here. The script reads, scenes 143 to 156, not yet written.
What does it mean?
Not yet written means not yet written. I haven't quite decided how to handle those scenes. They're the scenes showing how Doug disposes of the knife.
You threw it into the sea.
Well, there are several possibilities. That's the obvious one. And it is credible. You believed it, didn't you, Lily?
You did throw it into the sea.
Or I could have Doug hide the knife somewhere on that ship. Somewhere on the Lady from the Sea. As a kind of guarantee that the actress he loved would wait for him.
There's no place to hide it.
Only one sure place.
The police went over that ship with a fine-toothed comb. There wasn't an inch they missed.
Oh, well, they were thorough. I would say they missed about 6 cubic inches.
You didn't hide it. I don't believe you.
Well, you can see how these missing scenes affect the end of the story. Naturally, the part of Norma doesn't go to the end. It finishes rather abruptly on page 80. But if you're curious about the rest...
You didn't hide the knife. You threw it into the sea. You told me.
If you play the part of Norma, then you'll find out if I told the truth.
Tagger told the producer that day that I would play the part. If the knife was still there somewhere on the Lady from the Sea, I had to find it before anyone else could. It had my name on it. Norma's blood. Maybe they couldn't prove anything with it after 20 years. They couldn't prove murder. But it would be in all the papers, and it would be curtains on all my hopes for a career. I had 10 days shooting altogether on the part of Norma, and all my scenes were to be shot on location, actually aboard the Lady from the Sea. But I couldn't search the ship, because Craig was always there. Not only because he was the writer, he was acting a small part in the picture, too. So every morning, when I reported to the set, Craig was there. He watched me every second, every day. And when I left at night, Craig was still there, still watching. Then it was my last day, and Craig still had not written the missing scenes. My last scene was a scene in the deckhouse, where Norma is murdered by Gretel, as she is called in the script.
All right, we'll need it again. Honey, same thing, and play it quiet this time.
All right, Mr. Lundberg, I'll try.
I don't feel you're holding it in enough. You're sore at Norma, but you're holding it in. And you're a cook who knows how to keep your feelings to yourself, you understand?
I think I do.
Miss Dorn, you were great on the run through just before lunch. I want it just the same way.
All right, Mr. Lundberg, but it's... aren't we going to have the knife? I can't act very afraid of her if she doesn't have the knife.
Perhaps.
You!
Where's that knife?
Why, it's right here when we broke for lunch, Mr. Lundberg.
All right, get it. Meantime, Lily, let's go through it again, huh? All right, quiet, please.
All set. All right, quiet, please settle down.
Start whenever you're ready.
You can talk till doomsday, but I'm not going to divorce Doug, ever.
Then he'll have to divorce you. I'm sure he has grounds for divorce, Norma.
Possibly. But before I see him marrying a conniving, greedy would-be like you, I'll...
You'll what?
I'll kill you. I'll...
Cut! Miss Dorn, you aren't giving the same reading you did before. It's wishy-washy, like you don't believe what you're saying.
I'm sorry if we had that knife.
Hello, boys and girls, and Mr. Lundberg. Your suspense is over. I have brought you the missing scene.
Oh, Craig, let me
see.
Oh,
it's highest time. Oh, we shoot those tomorrow.
Here you are. And a copy for you, Miss Dorn. Oh, I forgot. Your part doesn't include these scenes.
Give them to me.
Oh, he hides the knife. I was sure he'd throw it overboard.
Hides it where?
Read there. Doug comes out of deckhouse, looks quickly around to see if anyone's near. Then he steps swiftly to the figurehead of the ship.
What figure? Oh, that woman right there on the front of the ship?
Yes, on the prow. They always had them on old sailing ships. A figure carved right out of the ship itself.
Doug hides it in the figurehead?
Don't you see how the wood is cracked open? The storms did that. He puts the knife deep in the crack. See? The insert shot. Doug's hand inserts knife and cap.
I knew then how Craig planned to trap me. He had hidden the knife in the figurehead 20 years ago in that very place. And all those years when I had forgotten him, he hadn't forgotten. He planned his revenge step by step. The script. Selling the lady for a movie set. Planned it to this day. The actor playing Doug would walk across the deck to put the knife in its hiding place. He'd reach deep into the cavity where the wood had rotted away. And he'd find another knife already there. The one with my name engraved on it.
Right after the stabbing scene.
Yeah.
Miss Dorn, what are you looking for?
She's checking to see if you really could hide a knife in that thing.
Ingenious, isn't it, Miss Dorn? The minute I saw it, I thought it was a great hiding place.
Yes. The only sure hiding place on the ship, Craig.
Find anything, Miss Dorn?
Yes,
I did find something.
Oh, the knife. Now, who could have put it there? Does it fit your hand comfortably, Miss Dorn? Do you think you'd be able to kill somebody with it? Act the part in the picture, I mean.
Stop it, Craig. Stop it.
You look quite terrifying this way with that knife. Maybe you're playing the wrong part. Maybe you should be the murderess.
Stop it, Craig. Keep away from me.
Oh, don't lose your head, Lily. This isn't... Give me that.
No! You put it there, didn't you?
Yes, but I... Lily! No, this wasn't... Lily, I only...
No! Grab her! She's killed him!
Somebody call the police!
I won't try to get away. I killed him, and I don't care what I have to pay.
No.
I don't care now if you'll find my name on that knife.
Your name?
Go ahead, look at it. The crew gave it to me when I was in The Unforeseen. It was my first big part. Look at it. The gold plate says Lily Dawn.
Oh, it says nothing. This is just a knife. We had it made up for the picture.
Yes, that's all it was.
No.
You're not on any knife. It's sure not on this one.
It's on the other one. The one cracked through into the sea. He said we would wed ourselves to the sea.
Tonight, the Philip Morris Playhouse presented The Lady from the Sea, produced, edited, and directed by William Spear. Our star, Marlena Dietrich, will be back in a moment for a curtain call.
You know, Miss Dietrich, this is the first Friday since the beginning of our Philip Morris Playhouse that I thought would never end.
Why, Johnny, what an unflattering thing to say.
Oh, what I mean is that ever since rehearsal at 1:30 this afternoon, the ushers have been neglecting to direct people to their respective destinations. The sound men have forgotten to load their revolvers, and every man in the cast has missed his cues. All because of your glamorous presence.
Well, thank you very much, Johnny. I enjoyed every minute of it. What is on the program for next Friday night?
Next Friday, we're going from glamour to the great Gildersleeve, who deserts comedy for menace.
Good night.
Good night, Miss Dietrich.
And now, goodbye, Johnny. See you next Friday, same time, same station, when once again we will present the Philip Morris Playhouse, starring Hal Perry, the great Gildersleeve. Until then... This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
The Philip Morris Playhouse on Tuned to Yesterday, a CBS broadcast from March 11th, 1949. And the curtain comes down on this hour of drama on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's golden age. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark LeVanier. Thanks for listening.